I'm Jonna Kaplan, a writer, traveler, and I run the site thesizeofconnecticut.com.
I'm Carrie Provost, writer, photographer, and general troublemaker, and you're listening to Going Steady,
a podcast about exploring places in the land of steady habits and beyond.
On this episode of Going Steady, we'll be chatting about how to do spring in Connecticut and what gives us hope. Then, we'll examine legends and lore in the region and consider what our travel horoscopes tell us. So you just got back from a little trip to Arizona.
I did. I went to Tucson. It was, I would say, my first real vacation in that I wasn't there for work in any way in like 10 years or more. I just wanted to experience being in a hot desert climate in an interesting city that I didn't know very well. So I did a bunch of desert botanical garden, desert museum, national park type things, and walked around some neighborhoods, and it was great.
Yeah, it looked beautiful. I was jealous. That was end of April, early May?
It was early May, yeah. It was basically a long weekend. So it was a long way to fly for such a short trip, but it was 100 degrees, low humidity, kind of a shock, but it was great. That's my favorite. Like, if I had come with an instruction manual at birth, it would say, keep in low humidity between 80 and 100 degrees or something.
Did you find that going to a really hot climate in spring where things are still so, like, it's hot, it's cold, it's raining for a week here, did that work out well for you, or are you just like miserable after coming back?
I still haven't decided. I've only done that kind of hot weather trip when it's not hot at home about two or three times in my life, including this time. And I don't quite know how I feel about it. I definitely needed it at the time and I really enjoyed it. But unfortunately, humans can't store up solar energy. So coming home, it was quite a, oh, we're back here again, and we're here for several months, and we're going to have to deal with the, you know, 50 degrees and rainy every day. Kind of had to acclimate to summer and then spring again, and I'm going to have to do it again in the summer, and I don't regret it at all, but I'm not sure that it's like a cure-all like people sometimes say that it is, because as we're going to be talking about how to get through spring in Connecticut, I think a lot of people right now, according to my Instagram, are going on tropical vacations or hot weather vacations. Maybe if you can go for 2 weeks, it's better. I went for like 3 days, so who knows?
Part of being able to deal with or enjoy anything is being prepared. So, you know, we were talking about this a little bit, and how do you deal with this season in Connecticut that you're saying is not your favorite?
I feel like spring is the combination of kind of the worst of winter and summer, because you get the really volatile weather with the thunderstorms and tornado warnings. And on the coast, we just get this miserable fog. but then you've also got, you could get a snowstorm, or you could get really cold temperatures. It's kind of just the worst of both worlds. And I've never been able to figure out how to handle it, really. Winter is a season that I don't naturally love. I'm not a cold weather fan, but I really made an effort to get myself prepared, and I have good boots now, and I try to wear enough clothing, and I try to force myself to appreciate the beauty of it, and I've come a long way, but spring is like a struggle. The struggle of spring is real.
So, umbrella, right? That's an obvious thing that you would have. I need to get a grown-up umbrella because mine is like a Target or CVS sort of garbage falling apart thing. A friend of mine who lives downtown, he said that one time when there was really, it was a downpour, and some stranger came up to him and was trying to sell him an umbrella by insinuating that his umbrella wasn't masculine enough. So he gave this guy a lecture about fragile masculinity or something. And I'm just like, hey, can you send that guy to me? Because I think I need a more butch umbrella than the one I've got. It's just like falling apart in my hand and I'm soaked. So the good umbrella, or at least something, is handy. The one thing I'm good about is having a waterproof or really water-resistant bag when I know things are going to be not so great because I don't want my phone and my camera to die. But short of that, I have people who regularly remind me to be dressed appropriately because I forget or I'm not I don't check the weather all the time. But besides that, like the umbrella, the not killing your electronics, what would you suggest?
Water-resistant coat, which I probably don't have a really good one. I have a trench coat. I don't have a real windbreaker type coat because they're so ugly. And the nice ones are so expensive.
They are. I borrow, like, other people have lent me theirs, and I'm thinking, this is super ugly, but I'm dry, but also this is not mine, and I would never. But it's so giant on me that it's so obviously not mine.
Yeah.
But I can't bring myself to buy one.
But I feel like if you really did it right, just for comfort, you have one of those massive yellow slickers with the hood.
Yeah.
And, like, I do have rubber boots. I do actually have kind of cute rubber boots. They're plaid. They're very, like, ironic preppy. But I've never found a comfortable rubber boot. I mean, you can't wear it to walk a long distance or something like that.
No. So I have, I think they cost me $12 at TJ Maxx. They are leopard print, like wedge rain boots. So they look cute. They're kind of dangerous. I've had an incident wearing them.
It's almost like spring needs a whole new wardrobe. You can't do much with your other season's wardrobes in spring. And I tend to complain a lot, like I'm doing right now.
In lieu of having a reasonable jacket, waterproof kind of jacket, I'll just like layer up things and then get soaked on the outside and just strip them off and have them dry. And I'm like, good enough. That's also, it depends on what the activity involves. Like you're saying, you don't want to look too messy. Depending on what I'm doing, if I'm camping or just outside all day, I'll go ahead and wear like the super ugly things. So it is that balance. Also, it was the sump pump, right? We're talking about the most adult thing that you can have.
The worst part of adulting, the sump pump. And Carrie's might have been in an electrical fire, and mine discharges water into a ditch in my yard. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we're failing the sump pump.
Well, I guess we don't want the cats to be floating around downstairs. No, I don't know.
Cats can swim. No, my basement does, well, I guess I wouldn't call it a flood, but it gets very wet, but then it dries up in a few days. So is that bad? I don't know. Am I giving myself some kind of mold disease? I don't know.
The only thing that came to mind was when we had those tornado warnings that I keep talking about, because it was like, it was upsetting. This thing went off on my phone and it was like, take shelter immediately. I'm like, oh my God, my phone has never told me to do this. And it didn't have...
it happens, but it's rare for this area.
I know, and it didn't have any other information. And it says tornado spotted in your area. And I was like, well, what's my area? Is that like the next county? Is it down the street? So of course I went outside to look. And then I'm thinking, am I going to have to go in my basement? Because my basement's kind of gross.
I feel like they're much more... No. The cat is lying on my foot. I know it's a podcast, but if it was TV, you'd see the cat lying like asleep on my foot right now. It's adorable.
Hi, Cecilia. She's letting herself be known.
Okay. So when I lived briefly in Missouri, you get a much more detailed tornado warning, I feel. It tells you what county it's in. Yeah. It tells you which direction it's heading. It tells you if you're in your car, get out and go into a building. If there is no building, lie down in a ditch, which always completely scared me. But I haven't experienced the phone tornado alerts in Connecticut yet, and I hope I never do.
Right. So that was interesting. So that's things to do in Connecticut in spring is take cover from the possibility of a tornado. This already happened, but there is in Meriden, they have a daffodil festival every year. I've gone a few times. Daffodils aren't my favorite. They're pretty, but they don't smell good to me. So.
I agree. They're not my favorite, but I did really like, despite completely destroying a pair of sneakers in the mud, another daffodil event, if you will, in Connecticut, in Litchfield, known as the Litchfield Daffodils, although I just found out it's officially called the Laurel Ridge Narcissus Plantings.
Oh, that's fancy sounding.
Yes, well, it's Litchfield.
Yes.
But it's this really cool, and I think if you look at Instagram, you can find out if the daffodils are still going, and I think they are, although it's a bit late in the season for them now. Mid-May, they seem to be going strong. I'll put the website for this on the show notes so you can get the directions and everything if you want to go, but it's like... I can't even tell you how many acres of daffodils of every possible color and combination just in these beautiful rolling hills. And it used to be a private garden of a private home. And now it's a foundation that runs it. and it's open to the public. But it's like something out of a fairy tale. And even though daffodils are kind of a pain, I think, when they're in my yard, but in this setting, and I would assume also at the Daffodil Festival in Meriden, they're gorgeous.
Right. But you were saying before, besides the festivals, what else
is it you do? Yeah, well, this is also over now because it was late April, but, you know, bookmark for next year in Worcester Square Park in New Haven. They have a cherry blossom festival when the cherry trees bloom. And I think this is good because a lot of people think you have to go to D.C. or Japan or whatever to see cherry blossoms, and you don't. They're all over, and there's some right here in New Haven. And probably even if you go there now, after that storm, there's probably nothing left on the trees, but there's probably still a nice pink carpet of petals on the sidewalk. And Worcester Square, in general, it's probably my favorite neighborhood in New Haven. I think it gets a little overshadowed by Yale and the more kind of less residential areas of New Haven, but it's their Little Italy, and it's going to Worcester Square Park at any time of year, really, is quite nice. I have an old blog post about it where I went in the dead of winter and froze to take pictures, but it's still worth it. Still really pretty. So, yeah, if you're seeking out, and I'm not like a gardening person at all. I don't know the names of anything. I don't know the science of anything, but I definitely seek out flowers after a long winter, because just to see something living gives you hope. One thing that I'm really into in the spring, is this website days.2, and it just shows you how many days until like any event that you put in. So I just keep looking, how many days till summer? And it tells you, you know, 32 or whatever. But, you know, another way of just kind of looking forward to better weather is to go to a park. Or, you know, like you were talking about riding a bike to get yourself outside.
Yeah. I will ride a bicycle. I'm outside year-round, but it's different when I'm using my bike specifically to get somewhere versus I'm just going to ride around and just play. And something that I've noticed in the past couple of weeks has been, even though I can't see them, the lilacs that are in bloom and, like, other plants that I don't know what they're called, but so that's been really fun. I have a lot more to say about bicycles, but I think you said going into greenhouses.
Yeah, I love greenhouses in winter and spring. And it doesn't have to be some fancy. It can just be like a garden store greenhouse. Mm-hmm. You know, some of them have really nice selections, and it's just being in a different climate.
Yeah.
For half an hour or whatever, seeing lots of color, seeing lots of life. It really sounds kind of silly, but it works.
It does.
It, like, improves your mood if you are, like, tired of the gray, rainy spring.
Every year, Elizabeth Park in Hartford, they do about a week of a greenhouse show. And it's one greenhouse that they have open. So you get a lot of people, depending on what time of day. And it is just that. And it's the same flowers every year, but it's going in there and being like, oh, this is nice, this is warm. It's usually March, I want to say. And then they sell all the plants at the end of the week. I have some friends who regularly go to the convention center. I feel like it's more in winter than in spring, but they have, like, the garden show.
I went to that one. That one is a little more, what's the word? Like, there are not as many flowers as you might think, but more sort of home. Right. I guess every convention-type event is like that, where there are booths of, like, home improvement-type places, and they're selling you garden accoutrements.
Koi pond.
Or something. Yeah, I don't
designs.
Even. Yeah, that kind of thing. Hey, it's inside and it's
right.
warm.
Whatever it takes. Back on the bicycle stuff, I've been doing that a lot more lately. And because I was thinking, well, what do you do in spring? And I was like, well, that's a good thing because you're getting to kind of explore stuff that you might have ignored for a few months. Last week, I went with my friend Angela. We went on a little bike ride up to West Hartford Reservoir, and she was towing her kid in one of those trailer things.
Oh, yeah.
And this involved some hills, but we totally did it, even though this was my idea. And then I started to be like, you know, maybe 5 minutes into this, going, can we just go to, like, West Hartford Center and go to Ben and Jerry's instead? Like, I want to bag this. And she was not letting me out of it. So I really appreciated that. As it is for a lot of people, probably not challenging, but if you're not in great shape, those hills can be a little bit painful. And also, if you decide we're going to stop at the grocery store and load up with tons of heavy things, not thinking you have to go up a hill. But all I could think of was I needed food. So I had donuts and Apple. I just had everything. I can't be trusted to grocery shop alone. So did that, and that was nice to kind of do the loop around the reservoir, and it's green, it's pretty. And it was like the middle of a, I don't know if it was a Monday or Tuesday, I can't remember, but not too many people up there. And did a last weekend, or the weekend before, did a ride that sounded mostly easy. This is one of those, we were talking about the yes and improv style of mm-hmm. bad decisions. This was that. So I thought, hey, it's a beautiful day. Let's go ride bikes to the park, which became, let's go picnic on the closed dump. Let's go camp someplace that you shouldn't be camping. And, okay, this is all fine. I'm going to ride my bike along the river. Well, things that you forget about is that in the spring, you know what the river does? It floods. So there was bringing bikes through floodwaters. Could have turned around and done something else, but no. And then it ended up raining. This was a last minute, not very prepared.
Didn't check the forecast.
I kind of did, but also, it was just a kind of half thought out plan. But it was okay, you know, because then I got home. The whole way I'm soaked, and I'm just going, the second I get home, I'm getting in the shower and, like, going to stand in this hot shower for a long time to cope with this. And I guess the other thing, a recent little trip, it was like a, this was last weekend, another one of these, I'm going to go from Hertford to Manchester on my bike. This is going to be challenging, but I've done it before, mostly on bike paths, and go to have breakfast at Cosmic Omelette, which I hadn't done, but I've heard great things about it. And I get out there, and of course, then I get breakfast, and I'm like pumped and thinking, I'm going to keep going to Bolton.
That's far.
It really, well, because my brain didn't go, hey, you have to go back afterwards. The getting to Bolton.
Going back, that's always the thing about you travel in general, you have to go home.
Yeah, so it was nice because you got, you know, along the way seeing the fiddlehead ferns and all the stuff that just, everything's coming back to life. It was overcast. It sprinkled for like 2 seconds, but that was it. So it was the threat of rain, but no rain, actual rain, so I didn't get sunburned. And then coming back in like around East Hartford, then I wanted to throw myself down like and have a toddler fit, but I did make it eventually when I was like, I need wine, get some wine and I'll like be motivated again. But at the Cosmic Omelette, they had this poster, they had an X-Files poster that I Want to Believe, which is basically my thoughts on this. But I know some people get really into legends and lore and the haunted kind of stuff, and like we'll plan to go places for those reasons.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's used for tourism purposes a ton. Like, you can't find a historic building tourist attraction in New England that doesn't have a resident ghost, can you? I mean,
No. And I made a list, and now I'm remembering other places that I had heard about, but I'd forgotten. So, like Salem, I guess Salem would be a place. I didn't go there specifically to see haunted things, but it's connected enough where you know, back in the day when I went there, you know that it's got the history of the witches. And so, no, I didn't see anything. So I saw a lot of strange things, but nothing supernatural. And like, that one stands out as, like, an almost seeking out a place for that reason.
Yeah, well, I think Salem is a good example of when a historic event gets co-opted into and obviously because of the nature of witches, that had a historic meaning, but of course it has also a supernatural meaning, and that gets played up, but the history of it to me is interesting enough in itself, and right. That's even acknowledging, no, these people were not witches, they were not communicating with the devil, you know, in the woods at night. The events around it, though, are interesting enough for me to want to see those type of places, and I think it's a fine line. So I do end up going to many places that claim to be haunted, but I think I just like places that are old. And, you know, it's something that I've noticed a lot, not just in New England, but all over America, is that a lot of places that claim to be haunted or claim to be possessed by spirits or something like that, I mean, they're haunted, but it's more by the history of what people have done to other people at that place. I mean, your old slave plantation is haunted, you don't say. Right? Yeah. And you don't have to believe in ghosts or anything supernatural to know that there's an atmosphere about a place where you know about the misery or, you know, or murder scenes. Mm-hmm. Like a house with where horrible murders have taken place. You have that grisly thought, you know, you can't not think of it. Okay, this place is scary, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not, we've talked about being scared of things before. Right. I'm scared of everything already. I have no desire to go to a place to scare myself for fun. You know, I'm not into roller coasters and I'm not into haunted houses and I'm not into Halloween things. But, you know, I love folklore. I love stories and history. So if you like those things, you're going to end up in a lot of haunted locations.
Yeah, I think you said it well, because there are places where, like, I've got my list of places, some places that are allegedly haunted around here. And I definitely agree that they have that haunted in an atmospheric sense. And that's what I was not able to put that into words. So one on my list is Cedar Crest Hospital in Newington, where I sought that out because it's abandoned. Mm-hmm. And it's an abandoned mental hospital. Like, why would I not want to go to that? And it does feel creepy, but there are various reasons for that. So we talked about this without naming the place on another show, and since have gone back and everything else. So it was closed in 2010, and it was, this is near the Berlin Turnpike, so it's not even like a distant location. It's fairly easy to get to. It was originally called the Hartford County Home for the Care and Treatment of Persons Suffering from Tuberculosis, and Cedar Crest Sanatorium. If something has sanatorium in it, you know, just like, this is going to be bad news.
Yeah, and we have yeah, a few of those in Connecticut, abandoned old hospitals or sanatoriums or mental institutions. And yeah, it's creepy because you think this used to be a place full of, like, sick people.
Right. People who had been, like, a number of whom had been, like, just tortured. Like, not being tortured by someone else, but probably tortured by their alcoholism or whatever they had going on. And potentially, if the place wasn't any good, right, there's just questionable medical treatments that have existed over time.
Oh, yeah. And just the way they used to build buildings that they mm-hmm. wouldn't these days. You get, you know, a mental hospital or a tuberculosis sanitarium, and it's gorgeous. It's like this architectural masterpiece, but it's also crumbling, kind of, because no one's been in it for years. And yeah, so especially if you like to take pictures, why wouldn't you? Like you said, why would I not go there?
You said you've gone to two, was it two in Massachusetts?
I went to, yeah, I wrote down, I was trying to think of haunted type places in the region, not necessarily Connecticut, but I went to one in Massachusetts and one in New Hampshire last year that I hadn't been to before. And they're different in that the Massachusetts location is called Dogtown. It's inland on Cape Ann. So it's between Rockport and Gloucester. And you think of those as, you know, they're classic seaport towns of New England, but this is inland. So it's very heavily wooded. It's got that, if you know anything about the whole glacial retreat period, so all the, it's like these massive boulders left over and just really rocky ground. It's a nature preserve now, so there are trails, but they're pretty badly marked. So the map is kind of useless and you could get lost very easily. And that's another thing that makes it inherently creepy. So it's very sparse. It's huge. It's something like 3,000 to 4,000 acres. And basically it was populated beginning in the 17th century by white people who had settled on the coast of Massachusetts, but who started to move inland looking for more opportunities to do with the timber or whatever resources were there. And that was called the Common Settlement. And it was a couple hundred people. They stayed there for 100 years or so. And then they started going back to the coast and getting back into the traditional seafaring occupations and what have you. And this is where it starts its haunted phase, is my air quotes. Because the people who were left over were outcasts. They were very poor. They were, you know, mixed race, or they were women living alone, or they were healers. And so there were all kinds of stories about witches and men who would be lured in there and disappear, and people flying through the air at night and crazy party, you know, basically the like 18th century version of like crazy drug parties and right. whores and things like that. And the name Dogtown comes from a story that widows lived there. War widows lived there alone with dogs for protection. And they don't know if that's actually true, but, you know, there's the story. That was definitely creepy. It was, I didn't feel like it was haunted by spirits or anything supernatural, but towards the end of its life, as a populated place, the people there were so poor that they were living in these like stone cellar holes, and they're still there, and they've been mapped and numbered. So if you look carefully amid the underbrush, you can see like these little stone kind of remnants with stones that have been numbered, and you can then go back and look on the map and see like which individual lived there and the story of their life. So that's something that's quite a strange thing to think about later, is like you try to imagine people actually living in a place where, you know, hiking for 3 hours feels a little bit creepy, but that was their home, you know. And then you think about like, it's called a ghetto a lot and writings from that time. So you start to think about, was it really, or was it like, you know, so many ghettos today, which is just where the respectable people wouldn't go, but it was a place where people lived and they were fine, you know, or they were forced to live there by circumstances, right. and they were miserable. We don't know, but yeah, haunted, but not necessarily by witches and things like that.
Yeah. Gay City State Park in Hebron?
Yes, where I have actually never been, which is so weird because near me and it's been on my list for, you know, years and years and years and years. I've just never quite made it.
So I know I'd been there as a child and it was like the standard pretty woodland woodsy state park. And then as an adult went back a couple times and that's where I started to see that there were foundations and things. And that was creepy. In that, for the same reason of, like, anything can just disappear. And so this was an abandoned 18th century mill village. And I guess there were some tales of water running uphill. And then, of course, the haunted stuff. But I didn't know that when I was there, I didn't know about that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And again, just felt like, hey, pieces of a foundation in the woods and it being overgrown. And wow, that's amazing that all these people just abandoned a place where they lived. But yeah, haunted, I don't know.
I think that's like definitely one type of quote unquote haunted place is the kind that simply because it was inhabited and now it isn't has mm-hmm. that strange feeling to it. And then the other one that I wrote down was kind of the opposite of that, which is Castle Island, New Hampshire, which is basically it's an island. I mean, you drive to it over a mm-hmm. causeway, but it's basically a small town, like a really sleepy, no gas station. Not much going on unless you live there. Very cute kind of seaside New England small town. Except there was this incident that happened there in 1682 called the Stone Throwing Devil or the Lithobolia.
Wait, what was that again?
The Lithobolia.
Ooh.
Yeah. And this family was supposedly, allegedly attacked in their home and in their property and in their other property that was some distance away by boat and just everywhere they went, attacked by some unseen force that would hurl stones and other objects at them and at their stuff and, you know, in some cases causing serious damage. And it was a whole kind of incident because, you know, it involved neighbors and it involved the government and it was this whole, basically, not an isolated incident. These kind of Lithobolia things happened in other places in New England, including a few in Connecticut, although not that extreme. And it was kind of like the witch hunts that we know more commonly, like Salem witch trials and the Hartford witch panic.
Right.
This was in that same vein. So basically, we know about this one because a guy named Richard Chamberlain, who was the secretary of the colony of New Hampshire, wrote a narrative about it. That was published a few years later in London. It's basically considered like an early horror story, and it's like an early kind of supernatural folktale, and it's available online, and I'll link to that. And there's also a more contemporary book by a professor about this incident, which, you know, in which he does not believe that it was caused by a real stone-throwing devil. But that's kind of place that's interesting to go to because some houses are still there from that time or nearly mm-hmm. that time. Some that have been owned by those same families involved in this for quite a while afterwards. And that's a place where you have to try hard to imagine something so weird and violent happening in such a quiet, peaceful mm-hmm. town. And it doesn't feel remotely haunted, at least not during the daytime.
Yeah.
But it's just really interesting to think about what people at that time believed and what they maybe didn't believe themselves, but they used for political purposes mm-hmm. or for like within, you know, personal feuds, like what beliefs they would exploit when they wanted to fight with each other. And it's an imagination thing, really, in cases like that.
Yeah, so New England Puritans were obsessed with devils.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I mean, we have the Devil's Hop Yard. Yeah. In East Haddam, another place where I didn't even think about the name or anything, and then until after I went, I was like, okay, something to do with someone saw some Satan thing somewhere, I don't care. If you think about all the places that have that kind of name, like Satan's Kingdom up in, oh, what town is that?
It's up on, like, Barkhamsted kind of area. Yeah. I don't know exactly what.
New Hartford.
Yeah.
So, and I don't know if that had to do with Satan or if that was just the name because it was sort of where the riffraff hung out, like the people who are on the edges of society, like just like camped along the river, is what I've understood.
I love those place names. And yeah, you can really figure out Puritans pretty quickly once you start reading the. But any road, like there's a Gallows Lane in Waterford, there's probably a ton of Gallows Lanes or something similar. Mm-hmm. Like anytime you see one, you know that something went down there and you can probably find out what it is if you look it up. And you know, it's never a good story. Except something like Devil's Hop Yard. It is actually an amusing little story. And yeah, and that's a great waterfall, by the way. If you're into waterfalls, go to Devil's Hop Yard.
And you can camp there.
Yeah, it's very pretty. But yeah, I think place names are like a very... If you want to, you can like get the whole kind of crazy Puritan religious vibe just from that.
Yes, the fervor of...
There's a witch meadow... In Salem, our Salem, Connecticut, not Salem, Massachusetts. Right. There's a Witch Meadow Road. And
in my hometown of Tolland, they have the Benton Homestead, which I did not go there because it was haunted. I went there because that's where we would go on field trips. So it's a cute old house, like old, because out in Tolland, so you had, I don't even know what century, whatever. Doesn't matter. It's old. It was one of those where you learned how they would paint. Like, only paint the front of the house or, like, one side. Like, where would they, if you're approaching on a stagecoach or something. Oh, right. And then they would, like, use cheaper paint for the rest of the house. So they did that on there. And the other thing I remember from this, so it's a place that's supposedly haunted. The family, a lot of them got wiped out by smallpox. They would be, now this is what I remember from a field trip that I went on in third grade. This might not be correct information, but I just want to hold on to it.
But
like
see,
that.
this is the important thing, right? Because it's folklore.
Right.
So it's what the third graders are getting and passing on.
Yeah, and remembering however many years later. So it's probably...
So this is probably like how we got these stories in the first place.
Right.
Because people in 1750 or whatever were probably not stopping to check their facts. They were remembering the story that they were told when they were 8 years old.
Yeah. Various members of the family, they're dropping off from smallpox, including, you know, probably children because that's the time and it's sad. And their bodies are being removed from the house through the windows. To avoid, I guess, spreading it to throughout the house because they don't understand how germs work or something.
Wow.
And they were buried in the yard, which is, you know, standard for that time, but not in our time. So probably the combination of enough kids who have been on this field trip, and this is on one of the back windy roads in Tolland. There are probably no streetlights out there to this day. So I'd say the combination of those things, plus it's a very small town without much going on, course you're gonna get your imagination going. And people have said that they've seen lights flickering in there because it's just a historical place, and I guess they don't have electricity wired for the top floor. So that's what I've heard. I know people who have insisted that that's the case. People have heard people crying in there, that kind of stuff. But it is also on the side of town where they have a really old cemetery. I mean, it's a few streets away, but I think kind of that area has that, like, you would go to the Benton Homestead, then you would go to that old cemetery, do grave rubbings, because that used to be allowed, not anymore, and hear about a bunch of really, really long ago dead people from, you know, Revolutionary War time or whatever. So, yeah, that's how I think this stuff gets started.
When you said smallpox, I thought you were going to go in a different direction, more in, like, the Vampires of Jewett City direction.
I have, so that, I'm interested in that, actually.
That is, I don't know if it's me attracting these things to myself or if the Vampires of Jewett City are actually kind of having a moment in the past couple years, but I've heard like two podcasts about them. I think Stuff You Should Know did an episode on it, and also Lore did one. But yeah, in Jewett City, in Griswold, And this was kind of later than you would think that this kind of thing would go on. It was in the 1850s. So, you know, not the super early Puritan stage anymore. And 40 years before Dracula was published, incidentally. So this family did not have smallpox, but they had tuberculosis. And it was just striking down generation after, you know, different generations, person after person, relatives in the same family. And they started to believe that the cause was the first family member who had died was actually undead, I guess, a vampire coming back to drain the blood from the living. So in order to stop it, they had to dig up the graves. They had to assess the corpse with all sorts of unscientific ways. Had to burn the bodies, I think. All kinds of creepy things were done. And this also happened in other parts of New England. I think Rhode Island has some very similar vampire stories. But yeah, I've never been there to see these things for myself, but there are still graves for this family. I think they're called the Rays. They have their little family cemetery, like you were talking about, mm-hmm. the little tiny rural cemetery. And yeah, and you can go there, and I've seen pictures. It looks very normal and, you know, right. Simply old-fashioned little graveyard. But if once you know the story, there mm-hmm. you go. And that's, if you're into this kind of thing, you probably know this already, but if you're not, Damned Connecticut, the website, is good mm-hmm. at sort of cataloging these places, and they do the Vampires of Jude City and pretty much like every other crazy story you've heard about Connecticut.
Yeah.
They'll review it.
I was recently on that, and I got sidetracked because I don't think it really fits in this category, but I have to talk about it. Fisher Cats, or Fishers. They have a whole page dedicated, and the comments, I didn't have the time to read through it because it's just pages and pages. People are really into Fisher Cats.
Which are real and not legendary.
They're real and they're not legendary. If you go into, probably a lot of other towns too, but the West End of Hartford has one of those Facebook group things, like the neighbor groups. And then West Hartford has a similar, and from time to time, they'll get someone who's insisting that they've heard the Fisher Cats screaming at night. Mm. And everyone is like, it sounds like a baby or a woman being murdered. And of course you're going, have you heard someone being murdered? And no one ever has pictures, but a lot of times people post video that's green, you can't see anything, or audio. And I've gone on them and I'm like, I'm not going to win these arguments, Mom. You're actually hearing a fox. That's a fox.
Oh, that's interesting. I never thought of that.
Or that's an owl.
But yeah, I always hear about Fisher Cats, but I've never heard one. And I wonder if there are actually not nearly as many of them, and people just think that any scary noise is a Fisher Cat. Right.
Yeah, but they're mean-looking things.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's also on that Damned Connecticut site, is a whole page dedicated to the Fisher. Which I think if you look at some of these things, actually, like, of what's haunted and stuff, you probably have people all the time hearing stuff, hearing animals they're not familiar with, in a place that's a little bit creepy, and then they're thinking, oh, that's the sound of someone who is coming back for their, mm-hmm. you know, they were taken too soon and they have to haunt their families now, and that's a wailing woman. You're like, that's just a screech owl. But okay. I think these stories are interesting because it's a way of, in a lot of cases, explaining medical phenomenon that people could not understand, right?
Yeah.
For the time.
And it makes you think, what about our beliefs today
mm-hmm.
that we're so certain of? Are people going to look back and say, what, how ridiculous, how could they have thought that or done that?
Right. You have that. You've got our, I think it's a need for being social, because when we find the villages that just everyone leaves or families are entirely wiped out, there's that sadness in that case. But that thought of things are so impermanent, and like what we think of as like our standard, we expect that Hartford's going to be here and East Hartford's going to be there and West Hartford's going to be there. And I don't know, things can change.
Right.
And that uncertainty, I think people worry about it and they infuse other explanations rather than just like people just needed to move on.
And so much of the abandoned places around here are connected to industry, like so mm-hmm. many mill villages. And it must have been hard to believe at the time when that was booming that, you know, one day you wouldn't need a grist mill.
Right.
You know, it's like, and that I think is reflected a lot in what we see today with coal mining and so on and so on. And, you know, factories closing and you know, maybe these things just aren't as sustainable as we want them to be.
So this isn't really quite in our region, a little bit outside, but I know you've been there to Centralia, Pennsylvania, because you wrote about that last year. I don't know, could you talk a little bit about that? Because I'm thinking the same way of, like, things that are places that are, like, just abandoned.
Yeah, so it's, I don't have the exact information. I'll put it, like everything else that we talk about.
We're never exact.
but essentially, it was a town in Pennsylvania, and there was an old mine, underground mine, that caught fire. And it just, they couldn't put it out. And it just burned and burned and burned for decades. And eventually, the streets kind of started cracking and smoke kind of started coming up. And people realized it was really bad when a kid, I think this was in the, I want to say the 70s, like a sort of chasm opened up and swallowed a kid. And he was able to be saved at the last minute, but, you know, easily could have died. And that's when people started talking about moving out, because nothing could be done. So a lot of people did move out. There were several stages of evacuation. A lot of people wouldn't leave because it was their home. And even if there was nothing there, you know, they just didn't want to give up their houses. So anyway, it's a long story, but the short version is that today you can go there. It's not really on the map. It's kind of weird because it's a tourist attraction, but it's hard to find. They had to reroute a section of highway because the highway that existed was impassable because it was like basically smoking and spongy and crackling and
wow.
So there's this section of disused highway that you have to sort of climb over like a weird barrier and hill to get to, and it's called Graffiti Highway now, and because it's just got thousands and thousands of multicolored different messages written on it with spray paint. And it's really, when you go there, it's crowded. So it doesn't have that that abandoned feeling of like an empty, like Gay City State Park or Dogtown. It's like there are a lot of people there. And I was there on some random winter day in the afternoon. But it feels very strange because it's very much of our time. Like it's a highway, it's pavement, it's got guardrails, it's got the yellow line down the middle still. There's nothing about this that is like of the past or the olden days. Like, this is exactly what it's going to look like when the whole damn country goes feral and is abandoned, you know? And there still will be people to come look at stuff, you know?
Right.
Like, highly unlikely that any, whatever happens, not everyone's going to be wiped out forever.
Right.
People are going to be there to look at this, you know, what once was a whole town, a whole state, a whole who knows what, that's now just unusable because the earth has eaten it, basically. Do you remember, this was a few years ago, but there was some listicle, it might have been BuzzFeed, it might have been somebody else, but they did, like, why, I think it was the Google search autofill, if you search, like, why is Alabama, or why is Florida, they did every state, and the top result for Connecticut was, like, why is Connecticut so haunted, or something like
that. Yes, I remember that.
So, like, and that's funny, because I didn't think of Connecticut as having particularly a reputation any more than any other state, right, especially New England state, of being haunted in any way. So I think that's funny that that's something that people have apparently caught on to, you know, because I've been to places all over the country that have their, oh, this inn has a ghost or whatever. Apparently we have this reputation, which is so weird. Mm.
We have old stuff.
We do.
If you're somewhere for long enough, I guess, you know, and I think the Puritans, thank you very much. Everything was the devil or a witch, and then we get the legacy of that.
Yeah, they were a frightened people much of the time, and they, I guess they left them the, like, impact of their fear of everything.
Right, and which it's easy to condemn, but if you think about, you're probably not going to live very long.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of death in childbirth. Right. Mm-hmm. And or shortly thereafter, it all seems mysterious because people don't understand germs. You can be kicked in the head by a horse. Like, there's just so many ways in that time to die and not many medical, medical opportunities. I mean, people are like bloodletting, you know, leeches. So I get that. And if something is like we weren't praying hard enough or believing in the right God enough, then that makes sense.
Yeah, and that's one thing that always kind of strikes me when I read anything written at that time is how many of them did sincerely believe in those things.
Mm-hmm.
They really did need to be better. If they were sick, it was because they were being punished for being bad in some way. But speaking of things that are kind of we have a far less less frightening, but also, you know, potentially infuriating to people who are completely skeptical, third segment coming up.
Horoscopes. Again, that's in the sort of I want to believe category, and I have to preface that because I've had some friends who are just like, you want me to look for what while I'm where? And I'm like, just tell me if you see a Bigfoot, you know, that kind of thing. I want it to exist. I listen to the Travel Oddities podcast. They're really interesting because there's some skepticism. And with horoscopes, I think of it as mostly entertainment.
I actually divide horoscopes from astrology.
Okay.
And I'm not saying that I believe in astrology because I'm not sure there's anything there to believe in that sense. But I think astrology is fascinating, you know, in the way that it goes so far back in history and every different culture, you know. And I also find it just anecdotally very accurate. Like, it's far more accurate than something like Myers-Briggs or any of those personality tests. Just as a personality indicator, you know, I find it's, like, it's pretty much correct. Daily horoscopes, however, I think are just, like, silly entertainment.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're so dumb that they're not even entertaining. They're just silly.
Right. They can be silly or good advice, like a generic piece of good advice. Like, you know, be nice to the people you meet today. Okay, I should probably do that.
Yeah, and that would, yeah, things that would like hold true for people born at any and on any day.
Right. But the astrology, the personal profile stuff. So I'm a Gemini, and this, and I think it could also be a crapshoot. Like maybe it's just I just happen to magically fall into the, well, 1 out of 12 times, you know, you've got a shot of it.
Right.
Or whatever. I'll just read a little bit of the traits, which they're almost all spot on for me, which is really surprising because, like, the Myers-Briggs stuff is totally off. So my strengths, gentle, maybe not gentle, affectionate, curious, adaptable, ability to learn quickly and exchange ideas. Basically, I'm a blabbermouth. Yeah. Weaknesses, nervous, inconsistent, indecisive. And things I like, music, books, magazines, chats with nearly anyone, short trips around town. Like, this is really accurate. And then dislikes being alone. I can be alone, but being confined, repetition, and routine. So most of that is pretty accurate. You know, I think there is some value in being able to say, well, that's me or that's not me. It can also be that way of getting to know yourself better.
Right. I mean, yeah, I'm pretty much a typical Scorpio, and I can pretty much recognize another Scorpio after hearing them talk for 5 minutes. You know, and it's not only that I'm very passionate and very loyal to people in my life and very, and have that dark side where I can also get, like, jealous and, you know, but it's also the bad things. Like, Scorpios are, astrology, if you start to read about it, it gets into sort of medical stuff, too. So, every sign supposedly has its own problems that it's prone to and like its own kind of bad behaviors that it's prone to and the ways that it can go well or go badly. Because obviously being a very sort of determined, passionate, intense person you could see how that could like turn very wrong. So you have to kind of try to keep it on track. But all of that said about my fascination with astrology, I think that travel horoscopes especially are like traditionally they have been a place where it's all fallen apart because they take that image of, in my case, a Scorpio and they say, oh, well, you're like, you know, deep and kind of spicy and whatever. So you should go to exotic locations like Bali or some, you know, go do ayahuasca in the jungle. And these are things that just, like, absolutely do not appeal to me. So we actually found some travel horoscopes. Like, see, okay, first I'm going to read an example of a very, very bad but typical travel horoscope, which is Scorpions love to holiday in those exotic places that normally others don't go to. visiting the pyramids in Egypt and the Great Wall of China would always appeal to them. They can withstand any climatic conditions. So obviously I can't. Right. We've just discussed this. Package and guided tours are not their idea of holiday. Well, this is true. I don't like package and guided tours. But this is like the kind of tripe. And I just, this was the one I pulled randomly off the internet. And I don't know where it's from, but they don't deserve the advertising anyway because that's terrible. But I thought it was kind of funny that the ones that we happened to find when we were talking about this were kind of accurate. Like, this one in Travel and Leisure, travel advice based on your zodiac sign, was telling me as a Scorpio to avoid crowds of people and travel during off-peak months or visit touristy places in unusual hours, which is pretty much like my travel philosophy, like off the beaten path, but not so completely off of it, but just going off-season. Or doing a popular thing in a different way that everybody's not doing at the same time, that kind of thing. And it also kind of gets into how Scorpios are very in control and like to be self-reliant and control everything in their life. So when they go away, it's important that they de-stress and relax. And those are both things that are difficult for me and things I should do. And I think your Gemini ones were pretty accurate in that particular article too.
I found, so one that I, again, I'm not going to name this because this is a bad one. I'm going to read this because it is that funny. Let's face it, sometimes you have to do things you don't want to do, like doing the dishes. I don't want to do the dishes, but I want a clean kitchen. So I have to work to, there's this whole thing about the dishes. And I'm like, okay, so I actually literally don't, like, I have a dishwashing problem, fine, but where's this going? And then it has something to do with going back into your body, and says, perhaps letting your mind relax and body stretch with a yoga retreat is just what the doctor ordered. And then it goes into this whole, go to this hot spring in California. And I'm like, no, that's, like, absolutely, like, the last place I would want to go. I don't want to even do yoga, like, go down to the park to do yoga. But one that is from Travel and Leisure that I thought was pretty interesting. So there's two things here. The first thing, it says, curious, quick to bore Geminis need destinations. So, okay, the yoga retreat, that's why that would be, like, I am, like, that sounds totally boring. But this is saying, need lots of activities and sites to explore. They'll swim with dolphins, wander through ruins, and discover the chicest boutique district all before lunchtime. They love chatting with the locals, and with their ultra-friendly demeanor, could quickly become an adopted member of any city they're visiting. And then it says, go to the Bhutan, known as the friendliest country in the world. And it has this whole thing about that. And I thought, well, that's interesting because that would have never registered with me, and that's not in the budget remotely. But you know, that's not a bad idea of, yeah, you like talking, go to a place that's known for being more friendly. So maybe for me, that would be someplace down south.
Right. I'm sure that, you know, if it was done well, a travel horoscope for me would not say that because friendly people, like, I would want to go hide. Yeah. I'm really, no, stop talking to me. But this one, I think this might be, we'll link to both of these, obviously. This one says, it talks about losing yourself on winding cobblestone streets and open air markets, and water as a water sign, loving remote beach locations where they can slip off the grid, which is much more the opposite of, like, well, the people might be friendly, but the cobblestone streets and open-air markets are good ways to kind of keep moving and avoid people talking to you. So that also, and it tells me to go to a spa in Belize, which, you know, is not specifically where I would go. But I like the idea of this very relaxing place, and apparently it's right near a bunch of towns and streets that you can, you know, small towns lined with vendor stalls where you can just kind of, and it uses the word quaint like 50 times. horoscopes are like most other things, and then if they're well written, you can take them a lot better than if they're not. So aside from the word quaint, you know, that's interesting. And this is like, of course it's all ridiculous, right?
Right.
But I think it's useful, much more so than if there were to be a Myers-Briggs travel profile. It's interesting because you can at least say, this is me, this is not me. I think most people, if they have a bad experience traveling somewhere, it's because they don't know, like, themselves and what they wanted in the first place. So they go, like, if you think everyone wants to go to the beach holiday, right? But if you went to a beach and sat on the beach for a week. You'd be so bored.
Oh my God. Yeah, I can't do that. I mean, when I've gone to the beach, it's go for a couple hours and go find other things to do. Yeah. I can't do that. I would, part of me does want to see for like maybe 3 days, like do that kind of beach, let somebody wait on me thing. But I couldn't, I don't think I could ever replicate that year to year. Like I know some people will go and do that. They'll find some place, maybe not Belize, but California or something, yeah, and Florida. Go chill out for a week.
Yeah.
Like every year you do that same thing? That sounds torturous, sitting yeah. still like that. I have another one here that it gives a week travel horoscope for a week, and this is for this week. So it says you're on the move at the beginning of the week. I'm trying to remember what I did Monday, and I just can't. I have no memory of Monday. Loving the variety of your trip and finding new curiosities every other minute. Your liveliness makes you seem to belong virtually anywhere. So you're getting the same kind of stuff going on. It says I should go to a flea market and get souvenirs, but I'm actually trying to like clean things out and have less stuff around me. So there's like bags everywhere of books I'm trying to like get rid of. And but then it says, how about renting a bike instead of a car? And I thought that was funny because this is kind of like, it's National Bicycle Month and there's like a bike to work breakfast tomorrow and a bike to something tonight. That's like, if you bike there, you get in free. So that's why it made me laugh. I'm like, I wonder if the person writing this, like, I didn't look at the other horoscopes, but I wonder if they like tried to work that in, like, hey, this is a seasonal thing. Let's put in biking.
That sounds like a one size fits all.
Yeah.
Type of, also travel horoscope by week is pretty funny because you're probably not going to be traveling every week.
Right. Yeah.
As opposed to like a weekly work horoscope. Which at least, right. you know, you do have to go to work every week. Most people do, so.
Yeah, I'm looking at, and they say, like, it was, like, this week, last week, next week, and next week it tells me to do something with parasailing. When I'm like, nah, no, let's not do parasailing.
Parasail that's down up there the with the ayahuasca. This rain keeps up, and just, like, parasail to downtown.
It can be interesting advice if you take it as a, I know who I am, and this is a different way to get me to think about what I want versus, well, the horoscope people are telling me to do this, so I should do it.
Right. That's like all advice, really. All travel advice. You should never do, I think, what a magazine tells you, unless it's something that actually resonates with you because it's speaking to something about your unique personality.
Right. Not sold on taking travel advice from the stars? On the next episode of Going Steady, we'll be talking about how to choose travel destinations, along with what to see and avoid in New York City. We'll also be revisiting bad decisions, but this time the kind that cut canyons through cities and remove foot traffic from streets. Thanks for listening to Going Steady. You can now listen on the Apple Podcasts app, iTunes, and Stitcher. If you'd like to rate or review us over there, that would be a great help. You can also subscribe to Going Steady and receive notifications by email. Sign up at goingsteadyct.com. That's goingsteadyct.com. Comments, suggestions for future episodes, hit us up at goingsteadyct.com.